Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I'm Darren Hefty.
And I'm Brian Hefty. Thanks for joining us today. Well, today on the show, we're going to talk a little about ethanol and renewable fuels. If you've got any questions for us or if there's anything you'd like to talk about agronomically that's going on in your farm, our number here is 844-44-AG-PHD. That's 844-442-4743. Or you can email us radio@agphd.com. So we're going to get to the Ag PhD mailbag here in just a second. I'll just give you a little update on what's going on our own farm. The weather has been record warm this week, so it's really been a lot of fun, like for our guys working on the farm, getting all this fall work done. We're doing tillage, strip till, spreading fertilizer. I don't think we've been doing any tiling this week, but just trying to wrap things up. And, well, finishing harvest is always important. I'm always thinking about, well, how can we set ourselves up as good as possible for the next year? And I just want to encourage you today, if you haven't done much for soil testing, if you have the time, I would do some. Even if you say, well, I'm going to have a tough time getting the soil test done, getting the results back, and still getting the fertilizer on this fall. Well, you can always put fertilizer on in the spring, too. But just having that information is tremendously powerful. And then you have all winter long to look at the information. You can even come to our Ag PhD Soils Clinic that we'll have in January. But I just would really hope that you can continue working on your fertility program because it's such an unbelievably huge thing. I know it's really transformed what's happened on our farm and our yields, and I know it can for you as well if you just keep working on that. So even for us, I mean, it's just every year, we learn one more thing, and we're going to try this now, and we got to get these levels up. And two, the farm economy hasn't been that great the last few years, so it's been hard to afford everything we wanted to do. But lately, we just have said, hey, we got to make these few changes, and hopefully things are just going to continue to get better and better. All right, right now, let's get to the Ag PhD mailbag.
It's the mailbag!
All right, I just handed Brandon a stack of soil tests here. This is from Kylie up in northwest South Dakota. Now, let me sort this out for you real quick, Brian. Base saturation K on average is 5. We got heavy ground. It's high pH when you dig down in the soil, but on the top, it's a little bit lower. In some, it's in the 5, some in the low 6s, in the top 6 inches of soil. They're no-tillers, and they're concerned that their calcium base saturation percentage is low. They'd like to get that up into the 60s, wondering what we would recommend. They're in a no-till situation. Northwest South Dakota, 12 to 15 inch rainfall is average.
Okay, so first of all, sampling this year, I don't know how accurate the pH is. It could be off just a little bit, maybe just a hair low in some spots. But here's the thing. It's like we talk about all the time, variability in the field. And when you said heavy soil, the first one I looked at was 11 CEC, and I go, well, wait a second, that's not heavy at all. There was one in here in the 30s, but I mean, it looks to me like variable soil types and then also variable fertility levels. So we've got some that's clear down into the 5s for pH. In those spots, then the reason why your calcium percentage is low is primarily due to, hey, we just have the pH a little low. So I would put a little bit of lime on there. You don't need to get very carried away because, to Darren's point, down below, the soil pH is fine, okay? But, I mean, once you get in the 6 to 24-inch range. Now, we've done tests where we've gone every 1 inch down into the ground, and I'll be willing to bet you a lot of money that in that no-till ground, your low pH is actually in the 4 to 8-inch range. So if you were to do this, just and maybe you want to take one spot and humor me, do, and I know this is a little work, but take the first inch and send it in for analysis. Take the next inch, send it in for analysis, and so on. You'll find that your low pH is in the 4 to 8-inch range. So I really question if we need much lime. I don't think we need a lot. Just a little bit's going to do it for you. And I wouldn't lime unless my pH is down in the 5s. Now, if you wanted to raise your calcium levels and your pH is 6 or above, that's where I'd be throwing on a little bit of gypsum. So if that's the main question, then that's what I would do. But here's the thing. just because you have your calcium a little low does not mean you're getting your yield hurt a ton. When I look at your soil tests, yes, the base saturation K is in the fives. That's great. But I'm looking at phosphorus that's really, really low.
Now, test says it's high, Brian. It says 16 parts per million in an Olson P test on one of them, and it had it rated as very high.
All right. So first of all, you shouldn't be running an Olson test when you got a pH down at 5.7, for example, on one that I'm looking at. I mean, a lot of these, the phosphorus levels are in the teens. That's not even close. That's 30 pounds of phosphorus you have out there. So you multiply that times 2.3. I mean, you got maybe a grand total of 80 pounds of phosphate in the soil. Your roots aren't going to be able to find that, and you're not going to hit your yield goals. So, no, the phosphorus is ridiculously low. But, you know, there are a number of other things that are low as well. I mean, zinc's less than one part per million in a lot of spots. Copper, less than one part per million in a lot of spots. I'd like my zinc to be roughly 8 to phosphorus to zinc ratio, 10 to 1, 8 to 1, something like that. So I'd love to see my phosphorus level, like on a Bray test, be at 50 or above, which means that my zinc's got to be 5 or above, and we're not even close to that. Copper, we usually talk about 30 to 1 ratio of phosphorus to copper, but I mean, as a minimum, we're usually shooting for 2 parts per million on copper. And by the way, especially as you go west, and this is the number one thing that a lot of people will say, when you're in northwest South Dakota, they go, well, my yield level's low, and I can't afford to spend much. Well, look, your phosphorus, your zinc, your copper, things like that, they are absolutely going nowhere until your crop eventually uses them. So if you say, well, boy, you're asking me to spend $30 extra or $50 extra on fertilizer. Yeah, but then you just maintain that from there on out. So it's a one-time investment. It's not like nitrogen where you're going to lose it every year or certainly every other year. So I would be working on some of those things. I also look at sulfur. I'm real low on sulfur in spots, but then we're real high in sulfur in a couple of spots. So we might want to be taking a look at drainage. There may need to be some drainage improvement in a couple spots.
I was just thinking when you've got the 6 to 24 inch sample, high pH and the top 6 inches low, that if you just did tillage one time, you could stir that up.
You could.
And maybe you'd fix a lot of stuff by just evening it out.
Yep.
All right, we'll be right back after this. Stay tuned.
Each year brings new and unique challenges to farming, and your operation needs to constantly adapt to meet them. That's why at AgBiome, we're working every day to bring you new and better solutions. Microbial-based solutions that protect your crop and help it reach its full potential. To learn more about how we're doing it, visit agbiome.com. That's AGBIOME.com. AgBiome, feeding the world responsibly, partnering with microbes for human benefit.
A history of success means proven performance, but let's call performance what it is. Profitability. And boosting yours, no matter what the season brings, is the goal of DeKalb brand corn. Backed by exclusive genetics, whole farm solutions, and unmatched dealer support. Let nothing shake your perseverance. Ask your dealer how DeKalb brand corn can help you realize a future of performance. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Bellum is Rotem North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Bellum. For more information, visit bellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
Your soybeans are in the bin, but the game isn't over yet. Score more points this year by taking your beans to the end zone. If your beans went in the bin at low moisture, you can naturally rehydrate to reclaim lost yield with the End Zone Fan Control System from Farm Shop MFG. At $10 beans, every point of moisture below your target takes away 15 cents per bushel. That means raising 9% moisture beans to 13 can increase your profits by 60 cents per bushel. Score more yields in the end zone from Farm Shop MFG.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. You're in for a treat. We've got some great guests lined up to talk about ethanol and renewable fuels on the show today. We'll also be taking your calls and agronomic questions at 844 844 Ag PhD, or you can email us radio@agphd.com. Start off right now with Jeff Breuen. And if you know anything about ethanol, you probably recognize that name. And fortunately for us, we grew up pretty close to where Jeff's at too. So we got to know Jeff a little bit over the years. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Hi guys. How's it going?
Good. Good. I'm betting on an election year, you've been extremely busy.
It has been very busy. It has been very busy working to educate the our presidential candidates as well as everyone else on biofuels and how important they are to agriculture.
All right. So Jeff, what are some of the points you'd like our listeners to hear today? And also, I'd love to have you talk just a little bit about how our listeners could get involved as well.
Well, there are quite a few things. You know, I think, you know, today farmers are facing a situation similar to what we saw in the 80s, you know, you remember the 80s like I do, and we were oversupplied and it was nowhere to go. Eventually, oversupply leads to, you know, set aside acres and storage programs. We haven't gotten that far yet, but that's the next thing around the corner as yields continue to rise and demand stays pretty flat. And, you know, what really turned that around in the 90s and 2000s was the growth of the ethanol industry. I used up all that surplus acreage out there and tightened up the demand for all commodities and raised corn, soybean, and wheat prices. And actually, they got really tight, in the 2000s. And we saw some great profitability on the farm. But I think what maybe people don't all understand is without biofuels, that never would have happened. Without, you know, ethanol using 40% of corn crop and biodiesel using 20% of bean crop, you know, we it wouldn't happen.
Yeah, I remember back in those days, Jeff, Brian and I went with our dad and we toured the first plant that you were involved in. And now you're the CEO of the world's largest producer of biofuels. I mean, it's been a big process. It's been a big change. And you're right. At that point, I remember dad talking about the first ethanol plant that he had a chance as a farmer to invest in. And he said, man, we're probably going to lose our money here. This thing might not fly, but if it does, it could be so good for farmers.
Wait, you can't finish on that, Darren. You got to say that he ended up making 40 times his money, I believe, when they ended up selling out eventually. So it turned out to be a great investment. But yeah, he just got in with a few dollars, and I mean, so ethanol has turned out to do really well. That's because of Jeff and his company's technologies and just how that's advanced. Because Jeff, one of the things I think that a lot of people have a big misunderstanding on is that all these ethanol plants get huge government subsidies today. The government subsidies were back when the ethanol industry was young and they were trying to develop and figure out the process. But that's not really the case now in terms of all this tremendous government funding, correct?
Yeah, the incentives are gone. I mean, there's a couple of very, very tiny state incentives left in a couple states, but the federal incentives are completely gone. By the way, the oil industry, who farmers compete with, whether they know it or not, still get subsidies, and ethanol does not. And we're still cheaper than they are. So we are the best value in fuel for the car, not to mention for automobiles, not to mention, for as far as climate change, we're leap years ahead of petroleum in charge of in the point of emissions. We are significantly, we get carbon dioxide and water out of ethanol. You know, they get 100 different toxins out of the tailpipe with petroleum,
right?
Most of which are very bad for you. Some are carcinogenic. And, we're the better choice. We're better, cheaper, and cleaner.
Okay,
and yet oil has been able to stop us politically. I mean, oil has really, agriculture would be in a much better position today had oil not had the enormous political power they have to stop ethanol at 10%, and we've been fighting for about 12 years now to move E15 into the marketplace. We're making small moves now, finally.
Now, you mentioned climate change. I want to come back to that because everybody's talking about climate change, and we have to go to battery-powered equipment. And I'm going, well, wait a second. When you're making those batteries, we got a real problem there. Talk to us just a little bit about climate change and how farmers can participate in helping reduce the whole climate change problem.
Well, agriculture, you know, a lot of people are saying agriculture is part of the problem with climate change. Actually, agriculture is the solution. You know, we need to return to getting our energy and our products from the surface of the earth. I think most people don't realize that everything on the surface of the earth, especially city people perhaps, is circular. If you make it from the surface of the earth, it generally will go back to the surface of the earth as long as you don't do some really bad things and convert it into petroleum or something. But you can make everything from a bushel of corn that you can make from a barrel of oil. And you can make everything from the cellulose and stock in the field that you can make. You can also make everything that you make from oil from the stock as well, from fiber. So there's tremendous potential between the starch and the fiber to replace petroleum, and then having, of course, protein, oil, and micronutrients as byproducts as well. And the oil can go to all kinds of uses. We're putting some of our corn oil now, modified corn oil, into asphalt. So we've got corn going into asphalt today. I mean, there's a good use of surplus corn. We've got products we're making that can do other things well. We're making hand sanitizer today. We've got products that will be going into cosmetics, all coming from corn. And so I think fuel is the big one. Fuel is a major market, and fuel is the one that can have the biggest impact on climate change. But there are so many other things from petroleum that eventually we can easily produce things from corn that now come from petroleum.
All right, but you said the oil industry has a tremendous lobby, which they do. So what do you feel needs to happen to ensure biofuels remain a strong market for corn? And how can we all do our part to help that come to fruition?
Well, I think ag companies and ag organizations, biofuel companies all need to come together. I think there have been so many diverse interests among all these different ag groups and biofuel producers and maybe even farmers in a lot of cases, because they're raising different things on the farm. But we all need to come together and tell the story of agriculture. We need to tell the story of how agriculture sinks enormous amounts of carbon and is sinking more carbon all the time as technology improves on the farm. We need to tell the story that when you get things from the surface of the earth, they'll go back to the surface of the earth. And really the problem here is petroleum. And agriculture has to replace petroleum in the coming decades if you expect to have any impact at all on climate change. It's the only near-term solution is agriculture. Everything else is tiny. The one that can really make a difference is agriculture. And agriculture needs to tell the story. If you don't define yourself, someone else will. And in agriculture, I just don't think we're very good at telling our story. Nobody knows our story. Some people don't understand agriculture.
No, I agree with that 100%. I've said this for a long time whenever I'm talking to non-farmers, that, look, crops are the big key to this thing. We're producing carbon out here. We're able to, well, you think about carbon dioxide is one of the big greenhouse gases. Well, that's literally what plants breathe in, and they put out oxygen. And the more we increase yields, the more of that carbon dioxide they bring in. So to me, it's more crop and higher yields. So if we do that, if we do that efficiently, we can have great positive impact on climate change.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just a little statistic here. U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Association recently stated that American farmland stores 100 times more carbon than the U.S. emits every year.
Yeah.
And every time you make an improvement to agriculture by using better practices, you can make a massive impact because it's such a big carbon sink. And one of the things we're working on right now, I think you're probably aware that POET has been collaborating with Farmers Business Network on a platform called Gradable. And we've actually even done demonstrations with this already and collected bushels under this, where, you know, under the right scenarios from a state like California, which will pay more for a cleaner fuel, we're hoping through Gradable in the future, if California approves it and other states approve it, that we could literally bring a premium back to the farmer for doing a cleaner or doing a more carbon positive type of farming. So if they adopt certain types of or they're already doing it and they already qualify, or maybe they adopt.
You're right.
There, strip till, and they can get a premium. That's where we're heading.
We see it a lot right here in our own state, Jeff, with no till and so forth. We've been talking with Jeff Broin, the CEO of POET. Jeff, thank you so much for what you do. We'll be right back after this.
Pentair Hypro Ultra Low Drift Nozzles are your ideal choice for the Enlist E3 herbicide system. With coverage comparable to flat fans and with 90% less drift, ULD nozzles meet all required standards for Enlist applications and provide optimal performance of contact herbicides. Learn more at pentair.com/hypro.
Your soybeans are in the bin, but the game isn't over yet. Score more points this year by taking your beans to the end zone. At $10 beans, every point of moisture below your target takes away 15 cents per bushel. Reclaim that lost yield with the end zone bin system from Farm Shop MFG.
Customer service goes a long way when trying something new. Ryan Shaw from Michigan shares how Soil Warrior helped him transition to strip tillage in his operation.
The Soil Warrior guys, they are amazing to work with. They made this jump in this transition extremely painless. One question that I get all the time is, how is the service and everything? And I said, well, actually, I get better service from them than I typically do my dealers uptown. They're just amazing.
More info at soilwarrior.com.
The only innovation that matters is the one I need.
With NK Seeds, their R&D program actually listens to farmers like me, so I get solutions that solve my challenges.
With the support to make them count. Because progress means pushing my potential, and success matters.
Push your potential at nkseeds.com.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, mare's tail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor herbicide brands. Always read and follow label directions.
Got resistant weeds? Add Tough 5EC as your post-emergence tank mix partner to deliver the knockout punch to Palmer amaranth and water hemp. Tough 5EC is a selective contact herbicide for post-emergence control of key broadleaf weeds, especially resistant strains. Tough 5EC is manufactured by Beltrum Crop Protection, an agrochemical company focused on providing innovative products with strong technical support. Ask your local retailer about Tough 5EC or visit BeltrumUSA.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
Fill once, plant all day. The Thrive 3D application system from FMC is a revolutionary in-furrow crop protection platform that plants up to 480 acres between refills. The Thrive 3D application system mounts to most major planter brands and can be yours at no cost with the FMC Freedom Pass program. To learn more, call 815-362-7747 today. Always read and follow all label directions.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. You know, today might be one of those days. If you're listening as you're driving a tractor and getting stuff done out in the field, you might stop for just a few minutes or engage the auto steer and get on a long round where you can just listen and maybe even take a few notes, because we've got some great guests today. We just had Jeff Bruin on, the CEO of Poet, the world's largest biofuel producer. Jeff's great. He's always working, trying to help farmers do better and tell the story of what's happening in agriculture. And, you know, there's so much misinformation out there. One place where Brandon and I like to go to find some good information is the Auto Channel. Mark Roush with the Auto Channel, it just does such a great job. He's put a book out called The Ethanol Papers, the whole story on ethanol fuel. And I know just talking to folks in the industry, they always reference Mark's stuff because it's really good and very thorough. And so we've got Mark Roush on with us right now. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure. My pleasure, Darren. Great always to speak with you guys.
So, Mark, we've had you on the show before, and what we really wanted to talk about today is there's been a lot of pushback against ethanol over the last number of years, and I'm shocked all the time when it comes from people who call themselves environmentalists. But we wanted to talk to you a little bit today about what are the top things that, let's say it's environmentalists or whoever's pushing back against ethanol, what's maybe the top two or three things that they say, and we just wanted to get your response to all that pushback against ethanol, because ethanol is a very positive thing. So what's number one on your list?
Well, probably the most, the recent hot button is the idea that ethanol causes ground smog, that it's causing more pollution than anything else. And I've heard this three or four times this year already, where there's been pretty big stories. And in fact, I even had a group from Australia call me and ask me my thoughts on it. So I wrote a piece about that, and it's nonsense. the ground smog that they're referring to is caused by, and by the way, ground smog. So it's the regular smog, but they now have titled it ground smog.
Sure.
But it's caused by gasoline. So it's exactly the same thing that has caused the smog for all the years. That's what it's being caused by. Now, in some parts of the country, some parts of the world, and L.A. is a good example, L.A. has always had an air issue. And they say that even back in the Indian times, that the L.A. basin had this issue because of the way the mountains surround Los Angeles.
Yep.
So the burning of the wood and whatever else they burnt, that created an issue.
Yep.
So that's this latest thing. Okay. After that, you have the hypoxia problem. Hypoxia is where you have lack of oxygen in water, and it tends to kill off the sea life.
Yep.
And so that happens in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's blamed on, of course, the farmers, and it's specifically blamed on the corn farmers. Now it's become specifically blamed on the corn farmers. Well, hypoxia is an issue that happens, I can't remember the exact number, but let's say it's 40 places around the world. And most of those places, they don't grow corn.
Yep.
So we know it's not happening from that. The second thing is that the issue of hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico was first noticed and written about in the 1950s. So if you go through history, you go through the chronology, and you see that, well, we didn't really start using a lot of ethanol, and we didn't start growing a lot of corn for ethanol until the 90s. So what does the 50s have to do with that? And by the 60s and 70s, they were already categorizing it as a real big problem.
Say, Mark, so, let me jump in on that one, because this is about 10 years ago. I went to hear one of our nation's leading experts on the Gulf of Mexico hypoxia zone. And we went through this whole presentation, got to the end, and I didn't get the answer to the one question I had. So I went up to him afterwards and I said, okay, actually it's two questions. I said, number one, how far back do you have records? Now, you mentioned 1950s. He said 100 years ago they had records. They had some kind of idea about the zone of hypoxia 100 years earlier. And I said, okay, so here's my main question. How big was it then versus how big is it today? And he said, oh, it's about the same size. I said, then why are we even talking about it? So it's all this propaganda that gets out there that's anti-farmer, and I don't understand it. So no, I agree with you 100% on the hypoxia thing.
Right. Well, you know, and I would say, let's say that between 100 years ago and today, or between the 1950s and today, let's say the zone has grown. Okay. But so then what I say to people is, you know that in the states that have rivers that feed into the waterways, that feed into the Mississippi River, that dumps into the Gulf of Mexico, that there are nearly 10,000 golf courses. And those golf courses are all using fertilizer on their grass, right?
Yep.
Then on top of that, you have all the additional houses that have been built, residential communities since the 1950s. Then you have all the corporate and academic campuses that all have these big sprawling lawns and things, right? And, of course, since the 1950s, we've had a population explosion, so farmers are growing more food so we can eat it, and therefore there may be more runoff, right? But all of that feeds in. So let's say if the hypoxia zone is larger, so that's the reason. So the answers are not to stop ethanol. The answer is, let's stop having golf courses. Let's stop building new houses that have grass lawns, right?
Yep.
Or or you know, and I'm not meaning to insult anybody on the next, but inevitably I always insult someone, so I'll say it anyway. We don't need wine that comes from grapes that's grown in the Midwest. We have really great vineyards in California and Oregon and Washington and yep. the East Coast. So it's like, so, okay, so let's do away with that if we were going to do away with something. But, right, so it's sort of, it's a silly thing. So the whole hypoxia thing. And then on top of all of that, if you really wanted to do something about it, so you'd go in and you'd farm the seaweed and algae that's growing in that hypoxia zone. You would use that to create more ethanol, and therefore it would clear out the all the algae that's growing. It would re-oxygenate the water. And then after they make ethanol from that particular algae, they then can use the remnants for fertilizer instead of chemical fertilizer.
Right.
Go
ahead.
So it's all silly, right? And then lastly, well, one of the other things on the environmentalist, so it's sort of just this thing about not just the smog, this ground smog, but the cause of other pollutants in the air. But different people, and there's one particular professor in Stanford that has written about this, but he keeps getting knocked down by other professors who disagree with him, and he's been in spats with them, and he's incorrect. And any time that I've communicated with the government labs about him, they always write very great stuff.
Yeah. So basically, he's saying there are other pollutants in the air, and that's just simply not true.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They blame other things, and some of the other things actually come from human breathing.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and it's cows and it's all this kind of stuff. Yes. Oh, one quick thing before we end on this hypoxia thing. And during our next segment, if you can hang on for us, we got a few more questions for you specifically to ethanol. But on that zone of hypoxia, we see that anytime there's lots of fresh water meeting salt water. So that, like you said, happens about 40 other places in the world on a big scale. Well, right after this, we'll talk a little more with Mark Rausch. Stay tuned. This is Ag PhD Radio.
Did you know soybean diseases like white mold and sudden death syndrome can survive in your soil even after rotating crops? Prevention of these diseases is a constant battle, and yield loss from an infection can be devastating. The right management plan makes all the difference. Keep your beans safe next spring with Heads Up Seed Treatment. Heads Up guards your seed treatment from both white mold and SDS. Stay protected and profitable by asking to have your seed pre-treated with Heads Up. Learn more at headsupst.com.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, mare's tail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor herbicide brands. Always read and follow label directions.
We now bring you an important news bulletin.
This just in from Live Action News.
Innovation has come to the world of burndown.
New Elevore herbicide controls your toughest weeds, even glyphosate and ALS-resistant weeds like mare's tail and henbit. Talk with your retailer about Elevore herbicide today and ask how you can start elevating your burndown.
You deserve to have a building that will last for generations. With more than 110 years of experience and thousands of satisfied customers, Morton Buildings is the industry leader you can trust. Unlike other construction companies, you work with Morton Buildings craftsmen from conception to completion. There's no better time to buy. Lock in your new building for 2020 today. Contact your local Morton sales office or visit mortonbuildings.com.
The next big thing is here.
From the system that brought you Roundup Ready to Extend technology comes a soybean like no other. Introducing Extend Flex Soybeans. Elite genetics, now with the addition of glufosinate tolerance. Learn more at extendflexsoy.com. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions. No dicamba may be used in crop with ExtendFlex soybeans unless and until approved, and no dicamba formulations are currently registered for such use in the 2021 season.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop, and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Welcome back to Ag PhD Radio. Brian Hefty here along with my brother Darren. Right before the break and during our segment now, we've been talking to Mark Roush. He is with the Auto Channel. Mark is an expert on ethanol. And Mark, I got a few questions for you. So one thing that a lot of people believe is that, well, let me ask it this way. Why are BTU ratings, in your opinion, misleading or even potentially irrelevant? Does ethanol actually have more power than gasoline?
BTUs are completely and totally irrelevant when you're measuring, when we're talking about internal combustion cars. It's a device, not a physical device, but it's a way to measure heat that was primarily intended when you're heating water to create steam. It has nothing to do with an internal combustion engine. But it gets used to talk about that because it's a way for them meaning the oil industry, to confuse the issues. To begin with, there's a chemist who is not with us anymore. He was a very, very famous chemist by the name of William Hale, who was around in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 20s. And he talked about the number one thing of being that the burning of gasoline is so inefficient that actually it loses about 25% of its heating value, energy value, when it's used in an internal combustion engine.
Okay.
And so he said, so about 116,000 BTUs versus 78,000 BTUs for ethanol. He said, it's much closer to being somewhere around 86,000 BTUs compared to 78,000. So now you're dealing with a difference of about 8% as compared to this mythical 33% difference between the energy levels, okay? So that's number one. However, the whole hypothesis that I've worked on for years and years now is that when we're talking about internal combustion engines, we're talking about an engine that is optimized to run specifically on gasoline.
Yep.
If all engines, every engine in the world, every internal combustion engine in the world, no matter whether it's spark ignited or whether it's compression ignited, if they all ran better based on BTUs, based on energy content, so-called energy content, then we could say that BTUs mean something. But that's not the case. If you take a gasoline, an engine that's made for gasoline, and you put in diesel fuel, which has higher BTUs, and you try to run your gasoline engine on the diesel, it either won't start, won't run, or it might run, but it'll run worse than the gasoline, right?
Yep.
So therefore, what's the energy content got to do with it? It's got to do with engine optimization. Now, we also know that engines that are tuned, but it's not just a matter of tuning. You actually have to use a different fuel injectors, for example, and you have a different piston stroke length and so on. But if you optimize your engine to run on ethanol, you will get as good or better mileage than you would on the gasoline. And the reason for that is that you do have more power from ethanol. And the reason you have more power is because you can have a longer piston stroke. And so a longer piston stroke gives you more power, gives you more horsepower. And that's why race cars back in the 1880s, 1890s, why they were using alcohol around the world. And it's why the best race cars today, if they are running on alcohol, they will beat a gasoline car. So the BTUs don't, so therefore they don't mean anything. And conversely, if you put gasoline, by the way, if you put gasoline into a diesel engine, you wouldn't just get 10% less mileage, you would get no mileage. The diesel engine might not start, yeah. Right? Or it would run very bad. So therefore, this whole use of the BTUs is nonsense, the whole energy content thing.
All right, next thing. There's a lot of talk about electric vehicles. What's your argument for ethanol over electric vehicles?
Well, if we could go to high-level ethanol gasoline blends, or just ethanol blend,
yep.
Just ethanol,
yep.
Not with even gasoline. The statistics that I have seen show that an ethanol burning internal combustion engine would be as emissions free as an electric vehicle.
Yeah.
Now, that's calculated based upon what it takes to make the electric to charge your car.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so in the global, obviously the car itself is going to be creating more, a car running solely on ethanol will create more emissions than an electric vehicle if it's just sitting there. But if we're talking the full picture of how they make the electric to charge the cars, it's about the same. And those two things, so they'll talk about how an electric vehicle is 40% cleaner, for example, than a gasoline
sure.
internal combustion engine. Well, so that's what you'll get if you had an ethanol-burning internal combustion engine. You'd get about that same 40% cleaner. So that's why it's equivalent. The biggest problem to us about electric cars is that, you know, electric cars first made their appearance in the 1880s. So they're not new, right? It's nothing new.
Yep.
And we've heard about electric cars for a long, 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 long time. Some states, like my state, California, is talking about trying to make it all electric vehicles by
right.
a very short period of time.
Yep.
We don't think that's doable for a variety of reasons. And therefore, in between today and that time, if it is as important, if it is as necessary to be cleaning up the emissions, and to at least a degree it certainly is, right? But if it's that important, if we're talking about catastrophic man-made climate change, then how could we not be using ethanol right now?
Right.
Like today, right?
Yes.
This afternoon, they should say, the governor, as fast as he came out and said, we're going to have only electric vehicles being sold by 2035, he this afternoon should say, as of tomorrow morning, we're going to have E50, E60, E70, E85 mandated.
So why doesn't he do that?
Because it's all, let me put it in terms of farmers will all understand, manure, right? It's all nonsense.
Yeah.
And it's the whole electric thing, to a very large degree, is simply a play to raise money for the states, because they are going to add money onto what the vehicles cost to manufacture. They are going to fine the manufacturers heavily if the manufacturers don't make available electric vehicles when they're supposed to. And, of course, they will have higher registration rates and things of that nature. So it's always designed to put money into the government revenue coffers.
Yeah.
And they don't know. They for some strange reason, I wrote a piece early last week, and I talked about this, that, you know, suddenly CARB is California Air Resources Board, and suddenly they got together with RFA and Growth and a few other people and have decided that they're going to start testing E15.
Yeah, I saw that. We've tested E15 for years and years and beyond that. Mark, if you wouldn't mind, if you could stay on with us for just a little bit. I know we've taken a lot of your time, but I got just a couple more questions. If you can hang on, that'd be great. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Ag PhD Radio.
We now bring you an important news bulletin.
This just in from Live Action News.
Innovation has come to the world of burndown.
New Elevore herbicide controls your toughest weeds, even glyphosate and ALS-resistant weeds like mare's tail and henbit. Talk with your retailer about Elevore herbicide today and ask how you can start elevating your burndown.
You would never plant seed or apply herbicide with a 20% success rate. So why are you still applying phosphorus fertilizer with a maximum availability of only 20%? Double your phosphate availability and increase yields with NutriCharge from AgroTech USA. NutriCharge's patent-pending technology protects phosphorus from negative chemical reactions that tie up your fertilizer investment. NutriCharge performs across all soil types and pHs. Contact AgroTech USA or your local Van Deese supply representative today.
Revitec fungicide from BASF has been specifically developed for the selective soybean grower who doesn't compromise. If you think good is good enough, if you're okay with just achieving rather than overachieving, if average is your goal, this is not the fungicide for you. Revitec fungicide, brand new chemistry, 3 no-excuse modes of action, 0 modes of compromise. Sounds like the fungicide for you. Revitec fungicide from BASF, that's smart. Always read and follow label directions.
When it comes to innovative herbicide formulations, you know Nufarm. Nufarm brings you Credit Extreme, the herbicide with dual salt technology that makes all the difference. Faster uptake, quicker rain fastness, and better control in variable weather, something we've all had our fair share of. When you need more powerful weed control for challenges like lamb's quarters and velvet leaf, with excellent safety to Roundup Ready crops, you need Credit Extreme. Nufarm and Credit Extreme, here to help.
It's about time. Applied at Planting, new Xyway 3D fungicide from FMC delivers foliar disease protection from planting to harvest. Active ingredient flutriafol moves from the soil through the corn as it grows for inside-out protection from roots to tassel. For season-long protection, choose first-of-its-kind in-furrow Xyway 3D fungicide. To learn more, call 815-362-7747 today. Always read and follow all label directions.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Welcome back to Ag PhD Radio. We have been pleased to be joined for about half of our show now by Mark Roush with the Auto Channel. And Mark is an expert on ethanol, and we've asked him a number of questions today. Mark, I got one last question for you. When we start talking about, and right before the break, you'd mentioned, well, right now the governor in California should just say, well, how about 40% ethanol, 50, 60, maybe 85%? Can normal cars run on higher blends of ethanol than what they're talking today, this E15? So can they run higher? And if so, how high can just a regular vehicle run?
They absolutely can run on very high blend levels. They can run on, we're basically talking about newer cars. So cars that have been manufactured with computers in them and fuel injectors.
Yep.
And so this is in the last 20 years. And all of these cars could use E85. However, they have to, the earlier ones will have to have the computer software updated so that the car can understand that something else is being used.
Sure.
But so let's say you don't go through that process. And that process, by the way, is supposed to be a very easy, simple, cheap thing that anybody could do.
Yep.
That any, you know, any shop could do.
Yeah.
So, but let's say they don't do that. So let's say we're just talking about E35, E30, E40, E50. Yes, all cars can use it right now. I've tested it myself on many, many cars. I've done splash blending. I've written about this, you know, endlessly. And I've done splash blending, which is I'll pull up to a pump. I'll put E85 into a certain amount into my car. And then I put E10 the rest of the way. And I did this, as I say, for a lot of test vehicles that I get to test drive. But I also did it with a car that I purposely purchased in order to do long-term testing. It was a 2002 Ford Taurus non-flex fuel car. And I ran that on everything, every blend level imaginable. And it always ran fine. And it seemed to run its best at somewhere about E40, according to my calculations. And those calculations would compare with calculations done by, for example, Glacial Lakes Distillery, Glacial Lakes Ethanol, who had done some extensive testing. And then there have been some university testing on blend levels around E30. And
yep, Minnesota higher. Corn Growers, when they did their big research, it was E30 that actually had the best fuel economy. So yes, So a lot, but a lot of people will say, "Oh, it's gonna cause harm in all these vehicles." So I mean, how do you respond to that? Why are they thinking that?
Well, because they're wrong. I mean, it comes down to it. One of the most basic things is somebody will say, "Well, you know, it melts the rubber, it melts the plastic, the rubber, all that."
Yep.
Okay, so. The funniest part about all of that is you say to a person, "Do you have rubbing alcohol in your house?" And they say, "Yeah, of course." You say, "Well, if you go look at the bottle, it's made out of plastic. And you probably had that plastic bottle in your bathroom for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years." You know, they last a long time.
Yep.
And the bottle isn't misshapen. The bottle didn't burst open and the alcohol ran all over the, you know, the cabinet. No, right? It's fine.
Yeah.
So alcohol doesn't do that. It's a lie. It's one of the myths created by the American Petroleum Institute starting in the 1920s when they were looking for things that they had to do because they knew that alcohol was going to stop being made again, and they Standard Oil had just founded this API thing, and they were looking for ways to knock it. But it's all nonsense. Now, the other thing is they'll say, you know, it causes all the gook and the goo and all that in the engines. Alcohol doesn't do that. Ethanol doesn't do that. That's caused by gasoline and petroleum distillates. Most of the products that are sold, the aftermarket engine treatment products, their magic ingredient, their secret sauce to get rid of the goo and the gunk and all that stuff is actually alcohol.
Right.
It's either ethanol or isopropanol or another alcohol. And if it's not that, then it's a petroleum distillate that is designed to act the same way that alcohol does, which is, and that cleans the mess up. It doesn't cause the mess.
Yeah.
So, but people, you know, say this silly stuff and because they heard it from their mechanic. And, you know, just because a guy is really great at changing spark plugs or really great at changing tires and fan belts, it doesn't mean that he knows anything about fuel. And they usually don't. You know, and the guys that do, those, you know, you take a guy like Andy Wicks or Andy Randolph or Bobby Likas, you know, people like that, these mechanics. And they say the same thing that I'm saying, right? And they laugh that, of course it doesn't hurt. But you get a mechanic that doesn't know. He doesn't know. And then, unfortunately, your uncle doesn't always know, and your dad doesn't always know, and your husband doesn't always know.
Mark, right? So. Yep, Mark, great stuff. Again, we've been talking to Mark Roush here. If you want more information from him, just go to theautochannel.com. Mark, thanks a lot for your time today. This is fantastic stuff.
Sure. Thank you, guys. It's always fun to talk to you.
You bet. Thanks. All right. So when it comes to ethanol, biofuels, we covered a lot of things today. You know, really the biggest thing that I guess I would say is that we didn't talk about is there has been this argument about food versus fuel. That's a myth, just so you understand. The food is really still there. What they take out of ethanol to make ethanol, for example, out of corn is they just take the starch. So all the nutrients, all the good stuff, the vitamins, it's all still in there, and then that gets fed to livestock. So if all you wanted to do is replace a starch, there are lots of easy, cheap starch sources out there. There are plenty of farmers who would gladly get rid of what a lot of us farmers even call trash. It's the residue out in the field. You just put a little of that together with your DDGs and you're right back to 100%. There is no food versus fuel thing. Farmers can supply both food and fuel. There's no problem with that. Many farmers I talk to often joke, yeah, there's never been a market that a farmer can't overproduce for here in the United States. And I think the same would be true for a lot of our Canadian friends as well. All right. One call that we had while we were on with Jeff or Mark, I'm not sure which. But anyway, it was Brad from Tennessee called to say that he thinks farmers get a bad rap for environmental issues, but putting a lime solution on the roads, and there's a lot of runoff from that. So I agree. Everything gets blamed on the farmer, yet it could be things that are thrown on the roads. It could be, like we were talking earlier, golf courses, cities. I would challenge you this. If anybody ever gives you a hard time about water quality too, just go to your river, whatever your local river is, and take an upstream water quality sample and a downstream water quality sample from any sewage plant, any city, any water treatment plant, anything, and you'll see real fast the amount of pollution that's getting caused that's not from farmers. So anyway, when we start talking about biofuels, it's such an important thing overall for the environment. Everybody's talking about climate change and help for the environment. Well, we have great stuff. If you use ethanol, if you use biodiesel, I mean, these are much cleaner sources. They're renewable. They're produced in the United States or Canada. I mean, it's done by local farmers. It's awesome. And it keeps the money inside your country.
You know, there's so many things there that Mark threw out that I thought were great. Just the comment about the rubbing alcohol in the house. Well, it's in a plastic container. And, well, if it's going to ruin plastic, wouldn't it have ruined that in the few years it's been sitting on your shelf? I also like this company said E40 is when asbestos fuel is run through a regular engine. I'm currently running E30 through, I don't even know how many vehicles I've done that now. I used E30 for years and years if I don't have a flex fuel vehicle.
Yeah.
Where we've had a flex fuel vehicles in the past, E85 has run great for us.
Hey, by the way, rubbing alcohol is about 70% alcohol. So, let's turn it around. 70%, it'd be like 70% ethanol equivalent.
Oh, one last thing. Back to what Jeff Bryan had said, that everything that's on the surface of the earth is circular, that, hey, we're growing these crops, we're using it for fuel. It makes sense that there's less pollution than if we're taking something from thousands of feet below. It was just a really interesting show, and I know everybody's got different views on ethanol. We thought it'd be fun to get some people that are really in the know that could give you some facts to chew on as well. Thanks for listening to our program today. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.